Appreciate the opportunity to be here. Most delighted to be counted worthy, though I know in reality I'm not, to appear on a program such as this. I was a little bit leery of what Doug McLeish might say by means of introduction. I fully anticipated what's been referred to as an acupuncture introduction. That means a little stick, a little point, a little jab, and a little needling here and there. Well, that didn't happen, so I think we're off to a good start. Might also mention that as we talk about the book of Hebrews, that I've had a lot of encouragement with the book. I've talked to Dub about various points, and repeatedly he's told me, well, it doesn't make any difference what you say. It's a matter of opinion anyway, and there's no test of fellowship to be drawn. And so I guess from that I can pretty much say anything I want to. Well, I conferred with Brother A.G. Hobbs about some matters, and he said, well, it really doesn't matter about this point or that point. And I almost got persuaded from some of the brethren that this lecture is fairly well unnecessary as far as an introduction. It might be called one of those necessary evils. I would say that in such a situation as this, that if we call this a necessary evil, it would be much like a preacher that Doug McLeish and I heard preach over in Arkansas one time when he read a newspaper article about some of the genetic engineering that was being done. He said, that's all right if you do it with coon dogs and if you do it with pigs, but he said, if you start doing it with my grandkids, he said, I'm going to do something ungodly. Well, he didn't mean by that what it sounded like he meant. And so when I say this is a necessary evil, I don't mean that we're practicing evil, but it is necessary, as Dub mentioned, to have a foundation, an introductory work, in order to understand the epistle. Unfortunately, the introductory work for Hebrews is one of the most difficult of works that you can engage upon as far as New Testament books is concerned. E.F. Scott penned that the epistle to the Hebrews, in many respects, is the riddle of the New Testament. And if you do much reading in the introductions to commentaries to the book of Hebrews, you find that Franz Delitzsch's statement is often quoted. In fact, it's become a tradition of writers to say that the book of Hebrews is like the great Melchizedek of sacred history. And that is that he is a mystery from beginning to end. Well, we first of all would do well to look at the history of the book and see its acceptance by the church. The first known use of the book of Hebrews was by Clement of Rome in his letter to the church at Corinth, which was known to have been written about 95 A.D. Unfortunately, in writing that letter to Corinth, Clement did not specify, he did not name the author of the book of Hebrews. However, by his use of it, he does imply that the book of Hebrews was recognized as authoritative literature at that date of 85 or 95. Everdale Harrison quotes Goodspeed as saying, Hebrews left a marked impression upon the Roman church, and all the early writings of Rome after its appearance reflect its use. But yet a strange thing happens. Western churches, of which the church at Rome was the strongest in influence, did not accept the book of Hebrews as being canonical for several centuries. However, Eastern churches must have accepted Hebrews as inspired literature from its very first reception. A Western work, the Canon of Muratori, does not even mention Hebrews. But a manuscript called the Chester Beatty Manuscript, which is an Eastern work or a work of the Eastern works, reveals in the East that Hebrews was considered to be an important work of inspiration, ranking with Romans and other Pauline epistles. General acceptance of Hebrews as being canonical did not happen until about the 5th century in the West. We first of all question, what is it that caused this division between the East and the West on accepting the book of Hebrews as being inspired? Well, essentially, the question centered around who is its author. Panteneus, a second century scholar, teacher, and elder in the church at Alexandria, is the first known to have attributed Hebrews to the Apostle Paul. Clement of Alexandria
was a student of Pantaenus and of his former teacher, Clement wrote, "But now, as the blessed presbyter, having reference to Pantaenus, used to say, since the Lord, who was the apostle of the Almighty, was sent to the Hebrews, Paul, by reason of his inferiority, as if sent to the Gentiles, did not subscribe himself an apostle of the Hebrews, both out of reverence for the Lord and because he wrote of his abundance to the Hebrews as a herald and apostle of the Gentiles." In other words, Pantaenus said that Paul wrote the work, but because of his position in reference to the Lord, he felt inferior in writing such a work and that he withheld his name on that account. Clement had no doubts about Pauline authorship in the book of Hebrews. F.F. Bruce stated, "Clement of Alexandria, in his Typosis, said that it was written by Paul for Hebrews in the Hebrew language." Well, next on the scale, as you come down from Pantaenus to Clement of Alexandria, you come next to Origen. Origen was a student of Clement. And I want us to pause just a moment in reference to Origen because of a mistake that is found in so many of the modern commentators in quoting Origen. Some modern commentators attempt to use Origen as a doubter of Pauline authorship for the book of Hebrews. They take his statement, quote, "But who it was that really wrote the epistle, God only knows," end of quote, out of its context, making it appear as though Origen really had no firm conviction whatsoever. Well, I'd like to read to you the section from which that quote is taken so that you can see the context and see for yourself what Origen was really saying. It's a lengthy reading. Please bear with me. Origen: "Again, it will be obvious that the ideas of the epistle, Hebrews, are admirable and not inferior to any of the books acknowledged to be apostolic. Everyone will confess the truth of this who attentively reads the apostles," reference to Paul, "writings. But I would say that the thoughts are the apostles, but the diction and phraseology belong to someone who has recorded what the apostle said, and as one who noted down at his leisure what his master dictated. If then any church considers this epistle as coming from Paul, let them be commended for this. For neither did those ancient men deliver it as such without cause." Now you can see from that the man Origen attributes the work to the Apostle Paul. Origen, in fact, says that Paul dictated Hebrews. When he says, "But who it was that really wrote the epistle, God only knows," Origen is speaking of Paul's amanuensis. He's saying, in essence, that he had a secretary, someone who was writing the things that he would have him to write. Now, we do know that Paul was one who would quote and have someone else to write for him, and in many of his letters he would take with his own hand to write the concluding remarks. We need to point out, too, a statement that Milligan makes. He says, "By this remark, however, he evidently does not intend to express any doubt as to the authorship of the epistle, but only as to the person who in this case acted as Paul's amanuensis." And so we have this idea that Origen was one who says, "We'll throw it up in the air. No one knows. Only God knows who wrote the book of Hebrews," being espoused by some today who claim to be scholars. And yet if we read the statement as Origen made it, we find out that he does attribute the book to Hebrews and commends any church that accepts Hebrews as a work of the Apostle Paul. One statement in Origen's quote which seems to have been overlooked by many is this: "Neither did those ancient men deliver it without cause." That is, that the ancient men, according to Origen, attributed the book of Hebrews to the Apostle Paul. Now, we have to bear in mind that Origen and Pantaenus and Clement were so proximate in time that it's not likely that, even going back as far as Pantaenus, It's not likely that these were the ancients that the man, Origen, was talking about, that they go back beyond that. It needs to be borne in mind as well that it's only a little more than 100 years from the time that Hebrews has been written until the time that Origen is born. And so if you're talking about 100 or 150 years, and he's talking about ancients, he's getting back very near the time of the writing of the book. Men ancient to Origen must have lived very near the date of the actual writing of the book of Hebrews. And none could be in a better position to know who its author actually was than these. Strong evidence in the East kept the churches there from wavering in their conviction concerning Pauline authorship. As the East was strong in its conviction, the West was weak in its evidence on the authorship of Hebrews. At first, the West seems to have viewed Hebrews as an anonymous work. Harrison revealed the error of this view when he said, "Hebrews is not an anonymous epistle in the sense that the writer is unknown to the readers, but only in the sense that the name is not indicated. The writer asks prayer for himself that he may be enabled to visit those to whom he is writing." At least until the 4th century, there was no tradition whatsoever of authorship for Hebrews in the West. There were denials of Pauline authorship. Irenaeus, Hippolytus, Caius, Cyprian, Novatian, and Victorinus were among the most influential Western leaders in the church. And these rejected Paul as being the author of Hebrews, the date being between A.D. 180 and A.D. 390. Only Tertullian, of all the men going back into the Western tradition, only Tertullian offered another author for Hebrews. However, it has to be borne in mind that Tertullian may have gone so far as to take the book of Hebrews out of the ranks of inspired literature. Hewitt remarks, "Tertullian, in his opposition to the Edict of Forgiveness of Maximus, quotes Hebrews 6, 4 through 8, and ascribes it to Barnabas. He thus clearly regarded the letter as un-Pauline, and it is possible that he also denied its canonicity." Now, I want you to bear in mind, nearly every one of the men who questioned Pauline authorship, insofar as recorded history is concerned, doubted that it was an inspired book in the first place. Today, the same can be said. Now, we see something happening in the history of the book between 200 A.D. and 392 A.D. A definite shift is seen occurring in the West toward acceptance of Pauline authorship for Hebrews. By 392 A.D., Pauline authorship was acknowledged in the West. The Council of Hippo in 393 A.D. declared that there were, quote, 13 epistles of the Apostle Paul and one by the same to the Hebrews. Now, that's a slippery way of saying that Paul wrote 14 books. But finally, they come around 26 years later at the Council of Carthage and proclaim, quote, 14 epistles of the Apostle Paul, unquote. And so gradually, surely, Pauline authorship is accepted. Even though Clement of Rome showed the book of Hebrews to be considered canonical as early in the West, particularly at Rome, as 95 A.D., it would take another 324 years before the church in the West would consider Hebrews to be Pauline and declare it canonical. Finally, the East and the West agreed and were united concerning Hebrews and its authorship. Now, we would think that the question's been solved or settled, but it's not, because the question is repeated. Just last week we celebrated, I don't know if you did or not, I didn't, but I'm told that we celebrated Martin Luther's 500th birthday. Martin Luther is given credit for having resurrected the question of Hebrew authorship. Rather than accepting Paul as the author of Hebrews, he questions its authorship and suggests maybe some other. His favorite was Apollos, as we'll see in a moment. Pfeiffer says Martin Luther suggested still another author, the eloquent Apollos of Alexandria. And he goes to Acts 18, 24 and 25 for his proof of that. I'd like to read to you a statement from Bruce. Bruce says, "William Manton, however, while conceding that Apollos would admirably suit the part and point of his Jewish Alexandrian origin and training, finds it difficult to think that the Alexandrian church would not have preserved some knowledge of the fact and view of the distinguished role of this son of Alexandria in the world mission, and that Clement would not have mentioned him writing to the Corinthians, in whose history Apollos played a notable part. You know, that's an interesting point. If this one, Apollos, who was an Alexandrian, had written the book of Hebrews, wouldn't Pandanus and Clement of Alexandria and Origen have some knowledge of that fact? And since Apollos was such a powerful influence in the church at Corinth, if that book had been written, that is, the book of Hebrews had been written by Apollos, and it was used by Clement of Rome in writing to Corinth, why wouldn't some point have been raised by him concerning that? I think Merrill C. Tinney best of all describes what Luther's choice of Apollos amounts to. Tinney said, many other names have been suggested for the author. And then he goes on and says, chief among them are Barnabas, to whom Tertullian attributed, and Apollos, a guess. And that's my emphasis of Martin Luther. A guess. After listing six of the most convincing arguments for authorship of Hebrews by Apollos, Lightfoot correctly observed, it must not be assumed that Apollos was the only man or the only Alexandrian in the apostolic period who could fit Luke's description as the eloquent one, well-versed in the scriptures. There is further difficulty that Apollos' authorship is supported by no ancient tradition. So far as is known, Apollos did not write anything. Well, we begin to learn something about Apollos. There is no evidence for Apollos having written the book. But there are other guesses about the authorship of the book. Harnack theorized that Priscilla and Aquila wrote the book of Hebrews. Chapman guessed that Aristion wrote Hebrews. Ramsey's choice, not Johnny Ramsey's, but another Ramsey. Ramsey's choice was Philip. Occasionally, Silas's name is mentioned. At last, the list could continue and go on and on. But where are the evidence? The evidence is for these various claims that are being made. I like Robert Anderson. I've never met the man in my life, and I've only seen one book that he's written, but I like the way he says things. Robert Anderson boldly rejected Barnabas, Luke, Apollos, and Clement of Rome as possible authors for Hebrews, and then said, as far as the other companions of the apostle, their claims rest on mere conjecture. There is not a scintilla of evidence to connect them with the book. Not a scintilla of evidence. Milligan stressed, hence, if it can be shown that Paul did not write the epistle, then indeed we may as well give up all further inquiry about its authorship and wait patiently for the revelations of the day of judgment. And you know, that's where a lot of people leave it. They say, well, we simply just don't know who wrote the book. And they give up. It doesn't matter. And then we hear people telling people like me, it's not important anyway. Well, it's a strange thing to me that we count the importance of authorship for every other book in the New Testament. Every other book's author is considered to be an important matter of discussion. Well, I think Hebrews is too. The amazing thing that you run into, it's almost, the general consensus of scholars spanning the wide-ranging churches that you can read commentaries from and see that generally it's agreed. Paul could not have written the book of Hebrews. And I want to devote some time to that this morning. Pfeiffer says, neither external nor internal evidence is sufficient to solve the problem of identifying the author of Hebrews. Bruce confesses, if we do not know for certain to whom the epistle was sent, neither do we know by whom it was sent. Wilson declares that the authorship of Hebrews is one of the unsolved mysteries of the New Testament introduction. A gist of modern scholarship seems to be seen when it comes to Hebrews, that we just cannot determine who the author was. Hence, the misuse of Origen's statement, "Only God knows." Saying one cannot know who the author is not the same as saying we cannot know who the author is not. In other words, we can say we don't know who did write the book, but we can say of one or two or three or four that we know they did not write the book. While modern scholarship denies Pauline authorship, and in giving these other suggestions, they come around to this confused idea of we can't know. Known to be a superb reference work, the International Standard Bible Encyclopedia boldly affirms, "We know enough about Paul to be certain that he could not have written Hebrews." Now that's quite a bold affirmation. Let's look at their objections. Let's see why they say he could not have written the book of Hebrews. And let me say this too. While sometimes I put scholars in quotes, generally speaking, I respect scholarship. I always respect scholarship. It's when the scholars become unscholarly that they leave themselves open to ridicule. Without a doubt, there are legitimate scholars who honestly doubt the possibility of Pauline authorship, and they base it on what they would consider to be sound objections. In fact, some say they view a few of these objections as being fatal to Pauline authorship. And if you're a young man in a college classroom somewhere and you hear some of these objections offered, it sounds pretty formidable. You just don't see any solution that can be found that answers the questions. Well, let's note some of these objections, if we may. Objection one, Paul does not identify himself in the address. One writer said, "Pauline authorship is rendered difficult, if not impossible, by other considerations." And then he lists the first one, "The author's name is not given." Now, just because Paul's name does not appear at the beginning of the epistle or within the epistle, some insist that it cannot be his work. I believe that this is one of those situations where what proves too much proves nothing. Barnes explains, "If this fact will prove Paul was not the author, it would prove the same thing in regard to any other person, and would thus be ultimately conclusive evidence that the book of Hebrews," parenthetical phrase mine, "that the book of Hebrews had no author at all." Answering this objection, Kaufman remarked, "Due to Paul's repudiation of Judaism and the fierce prejudice that existed against him throughout Jewry, it could easily have been that considerations of tact induced Paul to omit his name in order to prevent stirring up unnecessary bias against the epistle even before it was read. No such possible and plausible reason may be thought of as explaining why anyone other than Paul should have omitted his name. Who but Paul had a good reason for not signing such an epistle?" Men such as Kaufman and Barnes and Milligan and others who accept Pauline authorship generally follow the explanation given by Panaeus for the omission of Paul's name. However, there may be another reason for the omission. Strictly speaking, the book of Hebrews is not a letter. Hebrews is said to begin like an essay, proceed like a sermon, and then to close like a letter. More precisely, the book of Hebrews is a midrash, which is a rhetorical homily, or as some would call it, an exposition of Scripture. A midrash is an exposition or an expository sermon in written form, and it covers just a few passages of Scripture, and if you take the time, you'll see that primarily what the book of Hebrews is dealing with is Psalms 110, verse 4. Everything seems to revolve around the priesthood of Christ, but that's another point for someone else to deal with. If it is a midrash, if it is a sermon, if it is an exposition of Scripture, we would understand that it would not be written in the usual form that the writer would follow in writing just a letter. We see again that when all the evidence is considered, there's more evidence for Pauline authorship, even in this objection, than there is against it. Objection number two. Hebrews is written in a style very different from Paul's. I just want to use a quote or two from Hewitt here. Hewitt says, "Style and vocabulary should never be the decisive factor in settling questions of authorship. The Pauline authorship of Ephesians, Colossians, and the pastoral epistles has been questioned on the grounds of style and vocabulary. Although modern scholarship is perhaps more in favor of Pauline authorship of these epistles than it was 50 years ago." And if you'll just take the time to read some of the commentaries, you're going to find out that they say Paul couldn't have written the Pauline epistles, that the prison epistles or the pastoral epistles, because these are different in the style and style and vocabulary than were other epistles that are attributed to Paul and such like. As a matter of fact, you're going to find out that people deny just about everything about every book in the Bible anyway, if you'll look long enough and hard enough. Think Hewitt hits the mark. Too many things come into play for critics to trust their style argument. Style is affected by the circumstance of the author, the circumstances of the readers, who the readers are, the type of work that is to be written. You know good and well that when you write some of your near and dear friends that you use one kind of a writing, as in writing a letter, but if you're writing to the First National Bank, who owes you some money, or maybe you owe them money if you're in the same case I'm in, you use a different style, a different approach. And I would say that in writing this particular lecture for the lectureship book, I used a different style than I would normally use for writing even a bulletin article. So these things change. But I want us to look at this a little bit more closely. Upon closer examination, some scholars are saying there is not that much difference in style and vocabulary between Hebrews and other books attributed to Paul. In fact, we read of one by the name of Leonard. Leonard deals very extensively with the peculiarities of the vocabulary of Hebrews and shows that this difficulty is highly exaggerated. He also maintains that no other personal vocabulary that is known to us, not only in Christian literature, but in the whole range of Hellenistic literature, coincides so much with the vocabulary of Paul than do the 990 words which make up the lexicon of the Epistle to the Hebrews. I think that's a pretty salient point. Finally, on this point, the similarity between Hebrews 13 and the epistles of Paul is so very close that some of the scholars who reject Pauline authorship for the first 12 chapters of Hebrews want to claim it for the 13th chapter. From the text, it is apparent that such speculation is unwarranted. Objection number three. And I'll tell you, this is the one that gave me the most trouble. Hebrews 2:3 would disqualify Paul from being the author of Hebrews. That verse reads, "How shall we escape if we neglect so great salvation, which at the first began to be spoken by the Lord and was confirmed unto us by them that heard him?" It is argued that Paul is saying in Galatians chapter 1, verse 16, that he received his apostleship and preaching directly from the Lord, and no man had taught him regarding these matters. And that in connection with Hebrews 2:3, that the writer of Hebrews has to be a second generation Christian, saying that we receive these from those who were personally acquainted with the Lord and the apostles and what have you. So how could Paul say that the gospel was confirmed unto us by them that heard and still be considered correct in these matters? First of all, it has to be noted that even Paul had instruction from Ananias before his conversion, and evidently had contact with other brethren, other disciples, immediately after his conversion. If we had time, we would deal with the statements we find in Acts 9, 17 through 19, but suffice it to say right now that apostolic authority was not placed in Paul by Ananias. But it can be said that Ananias confirmed the great salvation to Paul when he baptized him. Paul definitely could have made the statement that is found in Hebrews 2 verse 3. Secondly, as an untimely born apostle, 1 Corinthians 15:8. Paul was not an eyewitness to the Messiah and his message, as were the other apostles. Having this thought in mind, thinking too of the other apostles' work among the Hebrews, Paul may have chosen the language in question. On this point, Kaufman commented, first, as regards Christ in his personal ministry, Paul was not an eyewitness and might appropriately have used such language with that limitation in mind. Third, Paul could have used the language under consideration in order to identify with his readers. By placing himself in the personal plural, Paul knew his message of exhortation would be much more persuasive. Hebrews 2:3 needs to be considered in light of Hebrews chapter 6, verse 3, where a clear distinction can be made. Here, the same author penned, "Therefore, leaving the principles of the doctrine of Christ, let us, emphasis mine, go on unto perfection, not laying again the foundation of repentance from dead works and of faith toward God. And this we, emphasis again, is stressed by me, do if God permit." Now, it would be concluded that the author of Hebrews, speaking in this passage, intended to confess that he himself was lingering upon the first principles, having made no effort to go on to perfection if we follow the same kind of reasoning that is used by some others. Well, what about other objections? There are other objections, but these three are the main three. And I would suggest to you that we can see what first appears to be fatal finally comes around to being less fatal than some would think. What about evidence for Pauline authorship? The earliest historical testimony affirms Pauline authorship. Pantaenus, Clement, Origen all declare Paul to be the author of Hebrews. We see, too, that the thoughts in the book of Hebrews are Paul's. Most modern scholars accept Origen's assessment, hence the reason for their selection of those close associates of Paul. And you'll notice that to be a peculiarity. Everyone that is suggested besides Paul as a possible author were close associates of Paul. They say they must have been close because it's too much like Paul to be otherwise. The author was a close associate of Timothy, and the book of Hebrews brings this out very clearly. "Know ye that our brother Timothy is set at liberty, with whom, if he come shortly, I will see you." Hebrews 13, verse 23. From the beginning of his ministry to the death of Paul, Timothy was a constant and faithful helper to Paul. Kaufman suggests, who but Paul in all the ancient world could have commanded the attendance of Timothy upon some projected journey? Milligan adds, indeed it seems quite probable that none but Paul would presume to speak for Timothy, as our author does in this case. We see by Hebrews that the author had been in bonds. We see that he's acquainted with Italian Christians. And we see in other places how that the book of Hebrews would be attributed to Paul. But I want to go over, if I may, to a man by the name of Peter, an apostle, an inspired witness. Generally, it's agreed that 2 Peter was written to Jews. In that second letter of Peter, an interesting statement is made. Quote, "And account that the long-suffering of our Lord is salvation, even as our beloved Paul, brother Paul, also according to the wisdom given unto him, hath written unto you." Now Peter said Paul had written a letter to the Jews. Where is that letter? There's only one possibility in all the New Testament. It could be none other than the book of Hebrews. Well, I see Dubs here. Please read the book. Now, I hate to sell books for Dub, but if you're going to get the lectures, I think you're going to have to buy the book. The date of writing, if I had time to explain it to you, I would firmly fix it 63 A.D. And I would say that the original readers of the book were Hebrews living in and around the city of Jerusalem. Some have concluded that the recipients of the letter lived at Rome because of the statement made in Hebrews 13:24, "They of Italy salute you," and they take the Greek word apollo and say that this means that they were outside of Italy sending greetings back into Italy. I conferred with a Greek professor at UTA, and he told me it could go either way, so there's no point to be made from the use of a po. But the point I want to make is simply this, that we see that the first idea of authorship is given to Paul historically. And if we look at the book itself, we can see from the very title to whom the book was written. The letter to the Hebrews. This is the title that's been on the book since its earliest date. All the ancient manuscripts carried the heading. And when discussing the book, the early uninspired writers called it by its Hebrews title. It's always been known as a book to the Hebrews. You look at chapter 1, verse 1, and you get another clue. God, who at sundry times in diverse manners spake unto the fathers by the prophets. Whose fathers? Who can deny the fathers here mentioned were the Hebrews of old? These were the fleshly ancestors of the writer and the reader of Hebrews. And verse 2 reveals that while the readers of Hebrews are of Hebrew descent, they have been converted to Christianity. Two quick points. Number one, all the imagery of the book of Hebrews, the temple, the altar where the animal sacrifices were made, go to the city of Jerusalem. Secondly, and something that a lot of us had not found before, at least I hadn't, maybe you had, that concerning the term Hebrews, there's a unique point that needs to be made. The term Hebrews does mean something in particular. Professor Stewart has endeavored to show that this was a term that was employed exclusively to denote the Jews in Palestine, in contradistinction from foreign Jews who were called Hellenists. Bertholdt declares that there is not a single example which can be found in early times of Jewish Christians outside of Palestine being called Hebrews. Delitzsch was quoted by Milligan as saying, "No traces," says Delitzsch, "are found of the existence of any such purely Jewish churches in the dispensation as the recipients of this epistle must have been." While the Church of Jerusalem actually bore the title, "The Church of the Hebrews." Well, if you take everything that needs to be said in an introduction, you come away with this. The book of Hebrews was written by the Apostle Paul to the church in Jerusalem about 63 A.D. And the purpose of his writing, as is evident in the book, was to encourage those Hebrew Christians to maintain the faith and not to go back into Judaism, which was such a great danger. I thank you very much for your time.